will come to order. It's Wednesday, May 15, 2013. Our first order of business is to open up a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 17. And ask Representative Widener to come forward, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJM 17 urges Congress to direct the Pentagon to reopen and review Leonard DeWitt's nomination for Medal of Honor for heroic acts during World War II. There is no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, representing most of Yamhill County and quite a bit of Washington County now, so with redistricting. Here in regards to HJM 17, to my right here is the gentleman that we're all here and listening to this bill about. I had a chance to meet with Lieutenant Colonel retired Leonard DeWitt, who's to my right here, on February 12th of this year at the Governor's Office for the Oregon World War II Memorial Honor Day. As an honorary board member, he spoke at this event and mentioned that he lives in McMinnville. After meeting him and his wife, we began talking about how Leonard DeWitt was nominated for the Medal of Honor for his actions in defending the U.S. position on Papua New Guinea against the massive entrenched Japanese fortification. During this encounter, Leonard DeWitt took personal initiative, single-handedly attacking the Japanese troops before they could sweep his company off the ridge. He engaged in a brutal hand-to-hand combat to protect his fellow soldiers and maintain the American position. Due to these heroic actions, the commanding general of the Sixth Army approved the nomination of Leonard DeWitt for the Medal of Honor, stating Sergeant DeWitt's conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty are worthy of the highest recognition. Unfortunately, for reasons not fully understood, this request for Leonard DeWitt's Medal of Honor nomination languished on the desk of General Douglas MacArthur. Leonard DeWitt, however, received the Distinguished Service Cross, the United States Army's second highest honor. You may wonder why he and his family are seeking the Medal of Honor after all these years, but Leonard DeWitt wants to honor all Oregonians who have served under the 41st Infantry. Sunset Division, the 41st Infantry Sunset Division, by giving the Distinguished Award to the museum in their honor. His continued thoughts of honoring all those servicemen who fought alongside him has propelled him to action, and today he is here inspired by the current Oregon veterans who have served their country under the same division. Society needs heroes, and his narrative encompasses the best of American ingenuity and coolness under pressure. His story of success against devastating odds can inspire all of us to invoke a collective memory of national sacrifice and honor that can be passed down through the generations of future Oregonians. Talking with him, even briefly, with a casual demeanor imparts the confidence to face any obstacle. I can think of a few more deserving this type of attention than Leonard, who's here with us today. We were honored, humbled, and excited to work for such a worthy cause and recipient. HJM 17 urges Congress to direct the Pentagon to reopen and review Leonard DeWitt's nomination for the Medal of Honor for heroic action during World War II. Since we are fortunate enough to have Leonard DeWitt here today, I will allow you to hear from him the recount and his heroic action that took place during World War II.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. DeWitt, please go ahead. I need you to state your name for the record, please.
You get to go ahead. State your name for the record and tell them your story.
Well, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Leonard C. DeWitt, Army retired. Where should I start? First, I'll say this looks like quite an August assembly. I'm too honored to be here for this hearing.
Yeah.
And so we have prepared, and I hope you got one, a couple of pages that I tried to sketch the situation that faced me at the time that I got involved in this fracas. And I think if you look on page one, you see that I Company of the 41st Infantry that I was with at the time had succeeded in gaining a position that was just a short distance, like 150 yards or so, from the bulk of the part of this huge Japanese emplacement that was protecting a naval base down to the left of the Salamoff Peninsula, which they did not want to give up. We wanted it, but they didn't want us to have it. So, and it was about 20 miles south of Leh, which was a big naval base situation. So all this was very critical to the Japanese, and they had had months to prepare this monster position that covered all of the Salamo Peninsula, and which was around 1,300 yards long by maybe 1,000 yards wide or so. And the 162nd came up at the little village called Boise, down to the right, if you check the map. And we started in from there, trying to work our way up the sides of these slopes to get up in there with the Japanese. It was impossible. They had dug that in so much, built so many bunkers, the steep slopes. We kept trying one, try them after another, and we'd go back and back up again for about several weeks. This whole campaign against that peninsula lasted 76 days and nights. And without let up, we were either hitting them or they were hitting us. And down at Boise, we had some artillery down to the west and some heavy mortars, two battalions or batteries of artillery. And so when we got up and finally managed to get down a place called Scout Ridge that led from back inland down into this big Japanese holding that was a little flat top thing about 75 yards long by 50 yards wide and very steep sides, luckily, and sloping from their positions to ours and then back to the rear. So we got in there and we dug in and we found an old tree. And as soon as they found out we were there, they started shelling us and shooting at us and everything like they usually did. And jungle foliage doesn't take much to make it fall down and go to pot. It's very soft stuff. So from their artillery fire and shooting at us, we soon had no cover left on this hill. It was all bare, except for this big tree, which all was left finally was a stump. And we had a nice artillery position, observation post, put up in that stump, where a guy named Turner could get up in there and direct the fires of these artillery batteries down below us. Well, that was probably one of the best pieces of success that we had up to that point. We'd been constantly driven back by the Japanese, and here we were, a little outfit, about 63 people, holding a place where we could get up in a tree stump and look out and kind of get a look at what they were doing and shoot off their cover and concealment. And this artillery observer of ours started in, and he soon had very dangerous for the Japanese to even walk around in their own area back there. Well, they pretty quick realized that as soon as we moved in, within about a day or so, they hit us hard. They came right down the slope from their positions. And in about 45 minutes of brutal fighting, we managed to drive them off. They happened to hit one of our strong points right in the front where we had a machine gun and people to support it. Well, they decided to try it again, I guess, because instead of coming down the slope or the ridge, which left them open to our fires, they came down around the sides and up, come up over the side, around the side. Well, I happened to hear this ruckus going on. I was about halfway back in a foxhole with the first sergeant. We had the company commander to the rear of us and another lieutenant over here. And we kind of divided up the responsibilities that way and for keeping track of what was going on. And with about 60 of us in this perimeter, we barely had enough people to cover the, what we had. So it's pretty critical we not lose anything. And when I heard all this ruckus going on up to my front, I got up out of the hole. I told the first sergeant where I was going. And when I got there, I caught four guys leaving, which is pretty bad. And in the dark, I asked them what's going on, and they said, well, we got a guy here that's wounded. We got to get him back to the aid station. And they ducked around me and took off. Well, I went over to see what four guys had left, and I found two foxholes there, and down below was this big, loud-mouthed Japanese yelling his head off, giving orders, and I could hear people hanging onto these bushes and things, pulling themselves up out of the bottom. And this was very alarming. I figured we're probably done for. But anyway, when I checked these guys' positions, they'd left a few grenades, and they'd also left a nice BAR sitting there on a tripod, bipods. A BAR is a, for those of you who don't understand, it's a big, heavy gun. It fires full automatic like a machine gun, and you can walk around with it shooting it. So I picked the thing up. I went over to where I heard these jokers coming up the sides, and I proceeded to get in their face with this big BAR. And I could hear them going back down the hill and falling and yelling and things like that. And which irritated the heck out of this big loudmouth that was down there in the bottom. He had a good voice, big, heavy bass voice that he could shout orders with, you know. And I didn't dare try to. I want to tell him his emperor slept with boys or something like that, but I figured my voice would sound like a little girl's. So anyway, he kept shouting at these guys to get back up, I suppose, and so then I had a Tommy gun with me. I dropped it when I picked up this nice BAR, and I took that thing up, and I had a couple of clips, and I went around giving those guys a dose of that. And when that was gone, this loudmouth was still yelling down below, and so these grenades we had were nice Aussie milled bombs, they called them. They make a heck of a racket when they went off. And they were a joy to throw because you could heave one and it sounded like it blew up half of the countryside. And so I wound up, and what I tried for was a tree burst, see, because when you hear a grenade hit closer, you fall down and roll a little bit, and usually it won't hurt you much. And so I didn't want those guys down there ducking the grenade, so I threw this thing as high as I could, hoping it would come down and land on this dude with a big voice. And he heard the handle go off. See, when you turn them loose, the handle flies off, it makes a little clang, and so I could hear from the sound of his voice, he'd go, up, like that, you know, and tell him, look out, there's a grenade coming, and then you could hear it hit the tree limbs. There's some trees left down below. All the rest shot off above them. And so, that gave me a little better idea. The next one I threw to the left. I had an area down there, I figured to where these guys were all in, or what I'd run off the hill. And I wanted to hurt as many of them as I could, and maybe they'd leave. And I was the only reserve in the company. It was just me.
Excuse
me. Could be a reserve. I had nobody else I could call on to come up and to give me a hand. So anyway, I sling up the next grenade, and then I waited just about time I figured it was exploding. I threw another one, and he didn't hear the handle come off. He was still yelling stuff, but pretty quick, I started throwing grenades to the right and left here. I had about 8 or 9 grenades. Some of these guys had left and a couple had fought with me. And in the process, I shut him up. I didn't hear that dude anymore. And I thought I'd had it made. I thought I'd won. And then all of a sudden, here comes a good Jap grenade. Now, their grenades the way they set them off, they don't have a handle or anything. They bang a little end against their helmet, and then it would start sparkling. At night, you could see the sparkles off of it. So way down below, I saw this sparkling coming at me. So I lay down one time, I got laid down right quick, I rolled, and went all of a sudden down a little ravine. I didn't know that ravine was there. And that's what these two guys, or four guys that were supposed to be holding this, was supposed to be guarding that little ravine, I all of a sudden realized. That, and this thing had a little grassy slope, and it was slippery. And as I, my feet went over the brink, I was happy to get down away from the grenade, but all of a sudden I realized I was sliding. And then I banged into two guys trying to climb up, I thought. And so I kind of landed on one, and the other guy was alongside of me. And so the only weapon I had left, we all carried a short grenade, a bayonet that they issued us when we got our new rifle. And we used it as kind of a can opener and this and that. And so I jerked it out and stuck it in this guy, and he went out yelling and hollering and got my bayonet with him. He's hanging up in his clothes. And so then I rolled off that guy, and this guy here is kind of like sitting here. So I didn't have anything else. So I took off my helmet, I gave him a big slap in the face with it, and he went down the hill. And then I crawled back up on top of the hill, and I was up there, and nothing to use for a weapon anymore. And I listened, trying to see if these guys had gone. And it sounded to me like they were either gone or leaving. And I couldn't hear the loudmouth anymore. So I figured I got that character. And so just in kind of a fit of spite, I took off my helmet and wound it up with the helmet, threw it down this little ravine just in case anybody else had idea of climbing up. And I could hear it go skittering down there and never hit anything. So I figured, I'll be darned, I did it. I wrote them off. And so I waited a little bit. I went over to the position that was still there to the right. And I told those people, I said, look, there's nobody over here where they're supposed to be. You guys keep an eye on that. I'll go get some people to put in. I'm going to tell these other guys on the left. So I went to that position, told them the same thing. And then I went over to where there was a lieutenant sheriff named Sheriff. And he was responsible for this area. I went down to him, and he looked at me kind of like I was a ghost. And I probably looked like I was pretty wild by that time. And I got close enough he could see me, and I told him, Lieutenant Sheriff, you haven't got any more people in the two positions there on up there. You better get somebody up there before I run these nips off, but there might be some more come. So I waited till he got a couple of guys up, and then I went back, and it was all over. And that's the last I knew about it. The next morning, I was kind of a little bit, might say, shook up a little bit for what I kind of went through. After I thought it over, I thought, that's pretty stupid. I did a lot of ridiculous things that night. I walked up and shooting right down into these guys, which they were like from here to there for me. And when you're down looking up, even in the night sky, you can see somebody. This BAR was flashing when I fired it. That's bad, you know, they could have shot me. And they should have thrown a lot more grenades at me than they did, but they didn't. But anyway, I think I really hit them hard, drove them off. And if they had got into our position, the thing I knew, I couldn't let them in. If they had got a toehold in there like they were trying to get, they'd apparently found that weak point. And if loudmouth, they got his group in there, they'd have got more right quick off the hill. And our unit would have been wiped out. We might have of us got away, and we'd have lost that beautiful observation post where we could lambast the daylights out of these guys up there and do more damage to them than all these other units trying to fight their way up. And finally, sometime a little bit later, they came in with bombers, and they turned every bit of weaponry we had on those hills and kind of blew the peninsula all the heck. And then we finally took the peninsula and got their naval base. And that's about what happened to me that night. I was a little bit more adventurous then than I am now. I thought back later that I wondered what I could have done better, but I think I lucked out. I think I did exactly what it took to drive those guys off. And I think about, there were a lot of Japanese coming up that thing. You know, I wouldn't go trying to attack somebody's perimeter with two or three guys. I would take at least a good platoon or something like that, you know, 15, 20, 30 guys. I think that guy had that many too. I kept thinking, I did that to them. That's pretty good, you know. So I never got a chance to do something like that bad again, but I went on to put in three more campaigns in New Guinea before the war was over, but I always kind of thought back on that I had a very lucky night, and so did my outfit. That's about all I got to say.
I think just in aspect of the story that you just heard, I mean, getting to hear when you're sitting one-on-one with Mr. DeWitt is very powerful. I mean, when he talked about bullets going over his head and everything, and just thinking, you know what, I'm not going to live, so I'm going to make sure I protect everybody here and stuff at the time. So, and he's got some great news articles and stuff that we will get to you. He was named the helmet hero and different things like that, so for what he did. And so he's got lots of stories. We got some videos that have been done by the World War II Museum that they've put together, and I kind of teased him because we have actually Bob Maxwell, who is a Medal of Honor winner that's here in the state as well. But when I was a kid growing up, I used to love Audie Murphy, and he was kind of my hero at one point. And now after hearing Leonard's story, to me that should be the movie that's made, and he's kind of taken Audie's place because after I got older and learned everything about Audie, he had suffered from a lot of things that we have to deal with in the veterans community, so that weren't recognized back then. So,
well, thank you for bringing this memorial to us, Representative, and Mr. DeWitt, thank you for coming today. We don't get to hear stories like this in our committee very often, and we're glad to have this opportunity to recognize you. So I'm going to close a public hearing. Oh, do we have a question? Yes, Representative Hicks.
So, Mr. DeWitt, thank you so much, sir, for not only your service, but also for giving us this opportunity to recognize it. I know that even when you're doing these acts and in the many decades that have followed, you're not seeking personal glory, nor in coming and appearing here today on behalf of this memorial, but it does give us an opportunity on behalf of the citizens of the state of Oregon to say thank you to you. And so that's the value of this memorial, truly, is nothing to you, sir, personally, but really to the citizens of the state of Oregon. It gives us a chance to say thank you, and for that, I appreciate your coming here and sharing your story.
Thank you, Representative. I'll close the public hearing on HJM 17, open a work session on HJM 17.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move HJM 17 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation.
Representative Hoyle moves HJM 17 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? No. The motion passes. Representative Widener will carry this for us on the floor. Again, thank you very much for being here today so we can do this for you. Thank you.
I will try to be as colorful as Mr. DeWitt when I carry this.
We're going to do, since Representative Parrish has been waiting and is missing a committee, is we're going to briefly open House Bill 3518, a public hearing. We'll hear from Representative Parrish, and then we're going to close that and move to a couple other bills and come back to 3518 for the list of folks who have signed up.
Chair, I was hoping that the DOJ could come up with me to clarify.
That would be fine. We'll bring both forward.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So open public hearing on House Bill 3518.
And Mr. Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 3518 modifies definition of social game for purpose of regulation of gambling.
Go ahead.
All right. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Julie Parrish, a state rep from House District 37, and I first want to say that I appreciate that our speaker sat down and had the conversation with me about social games and was willing to offer up the Rules Committee as a place for us to have that conversation more fully. Sometime back, I was with my sisters, and we go to, when they come to town, we'll go to bingo, and I'd heard from somebody who worked there that that one of the evening sessions was no longer available because of a loss of income due to kind of this burgeoning new poker kind of craze that's hit the area. And so they had basically taken a 20-year shift and closed it. It has been going on for, I believe, about that long. And I kind of tucked that away and didn't think anything of it. And then I was chairing working on a steering committee for a children's charity, and one of the members on that children's charity is here in the room today as an attorney who works, represents casinos in La Center, but he lives here in Oregon. We're working on the charity. He said, you know what, told me a story, you know, told me about these poker rooms that came up in a conversation, set it aside again, and then an article came out in the Oregonian that said that the city of Tigard was considering licensing bringing social gaming to Tigard. So I went back to Tom Rask, who you're going to hear from in a little bit, and just had some additional conversation with him. And it kind of took me down a path that I was not expecting to go, but come to find out that the majority of the poker operations in Oregon are operating outside of the social gaming statutes. So in the 70s, we had, in 1973, there was a social gaming statute that said that cities could, if they chose, to license and offer a permit for social games. And social games is very clearly defined. And then cities would have ordinances around what they determined was social games as it relates to our state statutes. And in 2010, the Lottery Commission actually asked for a DOJ opinion, which you should have as part of your record, I believe. If not, we will certainly get you copies of it, that basically defined what social gaming is and what it isn't. And based on kind of my understanding of how the poker rooms in our state are operating, it's pretty clear that they are operating outside of the social gaming laws. Above and beyond that, they're operating outside of the wage and hour compliance laws, particularly as in terms of how dealers are compensated with no workers' comp, and they are not actually technically considered employees, and yet they are being paid and are working shifts and basically doing everything else that an employee is doing. So on page 2 of the DOJ, it says, for example, one of the prohibitions is a house bank. We interpret the prohibition on a house bank to mean that the house may not act as a banker in a social game by having any involvement in the financial aspects of the game, including selling, keeping, and redeeming chips, even if the house makes no profit from doing so. It also talks about house income as one of the questions in here. Prohibition means that the house may not make any money directly from the operation of this game or from its participants. Businesses where social games occur may not charge participation in the game, a rental fee for the room, table equipment, or otherwise extract money from social game participants. And on the page 7, it's talking about what the definition of, between players means, and it talks about that you could have a person who is not actually playing be the dealer. However, it says, as discussed below, such a dealer may not receive a tip or fee due to the language and the player definitions of the player in social games that forbid anyone from dealing cards for a fee or remuneration. So it's pretty clear that you can't make money on social games. We do have opportunities if you are a school PTA and you want to host a poker night, you go to the Department of Justice and you get a permit to do so. And fraternal organizations, your kind of Elks, Mooks, Moose, Lodge, Order type, they can do that. And again, that's not the purpose of the club, and they're not making money directly from that. So we put forward a bill that says, okay, if you're going to operate social games, the bill you have in front of you, that it should be as a way to clarify this issue. It should be done by social, fraternal organizations, charitable organizations, or religious. That would bring it in line with this, with the charitable gaming, which is any of the non-tribal gaming in Oregon, besides the lottery, is managed by charitable gaming. You'll hear from Liz Grant a little bit more about charitable gaming. And to bring that into compliance, because what's happening now, if you go to a bingo hall who is managed and operated and licensed by the Department of Justice, first of all, they clarify that in their rules at the beginning of a session. They'll actually say, we are sponsored and licensed by the Oregon Department of Justice, as they state the rules of the house, and those are very clearly posted, and they are in compliance with our statutes. And the management piece of that is that every dollar is tracked, the books are open, and the player has confidence that the environment that they're playing in is legal and legit. Interestingly, you'll hear sometimes that the tribal games that are in our state, we have compacts with folks for tribal gaming. You'll hear that, you know, they don't contribute money to the state, and you know, and nobody's watching them. Well, the reality is that the tribal governments actually pay for 14 Oregon State police officers to babysit them. Basically, they have, again, access to the casino. They have access to records. Goal to keep the game safe and give players in Oregon a surety that the games are being lawfully managed. So poker right now is operating outside of any of that jurisdiction, and the question is has come up is, of course, whose jurisdiction is that? And so one of the questions I went and spoke with the LLC this morning, because it's come up as I've been barraged with emails and Facebook posts from people across the country saying that we're taking away gaming and banning gaming. There was a headline in the Oregonian that said we're shutting down poker rooms. Actually, this bill doesn't do that. It does require a change in a business model, if you will, but it doesn't actually shut them down. So because of all those emails, I went to our LC this morning, had the conversation, and they will be issuing a formal opinion for me. And I asked the question, I said, okay, for a moment, let's take for a moment. If we wanted to make them legal, operational business that is not charitable gaming and that is not casino gaming, what does that look like? Well, the interesting thing is in our Constitution, poker is clearly defined as a casino game. And casino, while it doesn't have a very specific does not have a specific meaning in the Constitution, the Oregon Supreme Court, as relates to a case where Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon sued the state of Oregon, sued the Lottery Commission, the court made a determination about what a casino is or isn't. And specifically, they said that establishments whose dominant use or dominant purpose or both is for gambling. So that's kind of that but-for question that we sometimes deal with when we're talking about the lottery, particularly those kind of lottery deli-type places. In fact, the Speaker and I are sponsors on House Bill 2007 to look at that issue as well. But for the gambling piece of this, would your business otherwise be in existence? And I do believe that under the social gaming statutes of charging, you can't charge money to come in and play, would the food and beverage portion of that be sufficient to keep their businesses open? And because of the issues of what I believe is kind of a law-breaking issue, it's not a matter of these are small businesses. These are people operating businesses that are doing illegal gaming. I don't consider that a small business issue. So we asked the question, could you do this? The interesting thing then we found out is that because casino is in our statute, we don't have casinos in our Constitution, and because poker is in our Constitution, we believe, and I will get a further ruling that says that we would have to run this out to the people to say that poker would be exempted from our Constitution in terms of gaming and gambling. So, yeah, you passed you around a packet of just some of these sites that are out there. And while you'll hear that they say that they're not a casino, it's clear in their advertising that they advertise themselves as casino, the largest and most spacious casino-style poker room in Oregon. You look at the types of payouts. The city of Portland has a very clear statute that says that the dollar amount for a hand of poker under their ordinance is a dollar a hand. So I'm not quite sure how you get to $20,000 payouts at a dollar a hand. That's an awful lot of poker. And so you'll see where, again, some of these places have advertised themselves as casinos and on Facebook, on MapQuest. And so that's kind of problematic. In fact, one of the poker rooms, I took a screenshot, if you look at page 7, on April 27th, advertised themselves as casino-style poker. After this bill makes the news, goes and scrubs the website and takes the casino reference off 3 days later. So it's kind of, you know, interesting that we're going to advertise as a casino, but we're not going to you know, we're going to say in this particular instance, it's not a casino. So you get a chance to see some of that advertising. And so one of the other pieces that came up, and then you'll also get a copy of a Groupon that from one of those folks offering casino poker Groupon coupon deals. One of the other things that came up is, well, if this is against the law, and as I understand it, and maybe DOJ, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, running illegal gaming is a Class C felony, and playing, if you're a player, is a Class A misdemeanor. So the question is, why isn't anybody enforcing this? And I've asked that question as I have talked to DOJ, and I've talked to the City of Portland, I have talked to the Mayor of Portland, I have talked to the Bureau of Labor, I've talked to a whole slew of people. And I guess I'm just kind of reminded of the enforcement piece. I'm sure some of you have heard this, you know, everybody, somebody, anybody, nobody. A little story about four people, name everybody, somebody, anybody, nobody. There's an important job to be done, and everybody was sure that somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, nobody did it. Somebody got angry because it was everybody's job, and everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody realized that everybody wouldn't do it, and it ended up that everybody blamed somebody when nobody did what anybody could have done. And who are the anybody? Cities, it's the DAs, potentially the Department of Justice, the Oregon State Police, the Lottery, the OLCC for the folks that are managed, County Health, Bureau of Labor and Industry, even the IRS. Everybody has sight of this type of establishment, and nobody has come forward to actually question how they're in business, why they're doing the wage and hour piece. And so I think knowing that, and the testimony you hear from the Department of Justice, knowing that, we now know that, and I think we have an obligation to solve it. And interestingly, unless we're going to run out of referendum to the people that says, a constitutional referendum that says we're going to exempt poker rooms, this act bill actually might be, with an amendment that would put them under the Department of Justice for enforcement, might actually be the only way that they can legally stay open before Boley and some of these other folks who've now kind of come to the table and are having conversations get in and do the enforcement piece and take it upon themselves to shut them down. So with that, I will pass over to the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chair Garrett and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. We are here just to provide technical testimony surrounding this opinion and some of these the issues around this bill. We are neutral on the bill itself. Start from the premise that gambling is unlawful in Oregon, which it is, unless there's a legislative carve-out which makes it legal. If you engage in gambling unlawfully, Representative was correct that if you are a participant, it's a Class A misdemeanor, and if you are benefiting from it by hosting it in some way, it elevates to a Class C felony. But there are carve-outs to that, two of which are going to come up today. The first of which is the so-called carve-out for social gaming, and I will discuss that, a little bit about its history, where it comes from, and how we at the Department of Justice concluded that it works now in our 2010 opinion, which we'll be referring to throughout. The second implicated carve-out is the current exception for charitable or fraternal or religious organizations who are authorized by law in limited contexts to use what would otherwise be gambling activities for fundraising. Elizabeth Grant, who is in charge of the Charitable Activities Division at the Department of Justice, will discuss that. So to start briefly with the social game exception. So there are really two types of social games. The first one's pretty obvious. Going back to 1971, the Oregon State Legislature decided that they didn't want people playing poker in their basement, whether or not they were doing it for money, to be subject to the same restrictions as everyone else. So they made a social gaming exception, which was really designed just to be, in the language that survives in 167.117 is a game other than a lottery between players in a private home where there's no house player, house bank, house odds, or no house income from the operation of the game. All those terms that start with house will come up again. I'm not going to go into each one of them unless you ask me to, but basically each one of those signifies a new way that a hosting association or business can get involved in taking profit out of the operation. Like, they run the bank, so they're cashing in the chips, they're providing the dealer house involvement. So if you and a bunch of buddies are playing in a private residence and there's no house, there's nobody who's sort of managing and profiting from the game, then you fall under that initial 1971 definition of social gaming. But when the legislature passed that in 1971, what they found is there was an uproar from all of the local businesses that had card rooms, used still see a few of these floating around in the older Oregon bars. There's one at the Lotus in Portland still labeled card room. And this is basically, you'd go in, you'd play poker with your friends, and the bar wasn't directly involved, except they had the privilege of serving you food and drink. And then in 1973, the issue came up of, well, how does really that work? If we're going to reauthorize that, can we allow a cover for use of the card room? And in 1973, that amount was fixed at 25%. Basically, 25% of the profit that you're making can be from the operation or of those card games, and then you're still basically just hosting as a social game. Anything more than that, you start moving into being a professional gambling establishment, which made the legislature in 1973 nervous. They came back 1 year later in 74 and basically retracted that because it was their experience that 25% intake figure had caused such a dramatic uptick in gambling establishments, and the legislative history back then calls professional gambling establishments, that only 1 year after enactment, they got rid of that provision and basically just went back to social gaming as it exists today. So social gaming as we have it now. There's what I talked about earlier. And then the second category is, if authorized pursuant to ORS 167121, what that's referring to is basically licensed by a municipality to do so, a game other than a lottery between players in a private business, private club, or place of public accommodation where no house player, house bank, or house odds exist, and there is no house income from the operation of the social game. So the question that's really before you as a committee right now is the extent to which businesses that are currently operating within Oregon are or are not violating the parameters of that statutory provision. The Department of Justice has been asked that question both in 2010 and now, and we issued an opinion in 2010, which is the basis for my testimony. And I'll summarize my conclusions, the conclusions of the Department of Justice. Private businesses, private clubs, or places of public accommodation that allow social games and their personnel may not derive any income from the game, including charging cover, usage, or rental charges for the place or equipment, or extract any money directly from the participants other than via the sale of food and drink on the same terms as all other patrons. They can't inflate their prices in a way that suggests that, you know, you're paying $20 for a beer to cover the cost of playing poker. They cannot themselves compete or bet in the game. They cannot act as the banker by handling the chips, cashing you in and out, even if they make no profit from doing so. And they can't have any advantage or set the ratio between the payout and bet amount, meaning they can't set the odds in any way. And so we believe that that's a sort of our statement of the current state of the law as it is applied, that that is what you'd be violating. So the question we've been asked frequently is, what does...
Is that in any written testimony?
Well, it's in the opinion.
Okay.
I cited almost... Chair
Garrett. I have a 2010 opinion here.
Yes. Let me call your attention then to page 15 of that opinion, Chair Garrett, members of the committee.
Is that on OLIS?
A paper copy was given to me, but I'm not sure if it was distributed.
I was looking for it.
So about two-thirds of the way down, there's a subsection conclusion, which itemizes what I just described. So it is in there, page 15.
Well, okay, just to go over a couple of the high points of what you said.
Sure.
Can't derive income from the game, including by charging a cover.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, that's the real question. At what point is your charging a cover or a usage or an hourly or anything for the ability to play poker converting you to a gambling establishment? The legislative history coming out of the 73 and 74 sessions suggests that if that's where you're making your money, then you're violative of the statute. Charging a cover specifically for the ability to play poker would certainly move you significantly in that direction.
So can you address Representative Parrish's comment on the constitutional piece of this?
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, I believe we're going to move to that momentarily.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Grant's testimony will contain some analysis on that, I believe.
Right.
The only other remark I want to get on the record before we move on is the Department of Justice has received several inquiries about how enforcement responsibility on both the civil and criminal side is presently assigned here. As I mentioned up front, if gambling activity truly is unlawful, it violates criminal statutes. That was also cited to by Representative Parrish. The responsibility for criminal prosecution in the absence of other authorizing language always defaults to the district attorney. That is the chief responsibility of the district attorney as directed by their county, as directed by their municipality. The Department of Justice does get involved in criminal prosecution. We typically do that on invitation only in the absence of statutory authorization, which does not exist here. And I want to be clear, I'm not here requesting it. I'm only describing the scope of enforcement. Civil remedies, again, we believe would lie most principally with the municipality themselves. As I mentioned earlier, there's a licensing requirement that usually acts as the authorizing mechanism for this to happen in the first place. So regulatory responsibility would begin most immediately with that municipality. I'm going to allow, I think Elizabeth Grant should testify, and then we'll both be open for any technical questions.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Grant, and I'm an attorney in charge of the Charitable Activities Section of the Department of Justice. In addition to other responsibilities, our office regulates nonprofit gaming. Before I forget, I would like to first talk about some of the constitutional issues that arise in this context. Nonprofit gaming has been specifically authorized in the Constitution through an amendment so that nonprofit organizations are permitted by the Constitution to engage in certain forms of gaming. There's also a constitutional prohibition against casinos, and it's not an area that I'm necessarily that well versed in, but I understand that Ecumenical Ministries is the lead case on describing what a casino is, and that case described that if it's a premise that's predominantly for the purpose of gaming, that constitutes a casino. And that it does come up somewhat in the lottery context, and that's why there's certain limits in place in the lottery. And it sometimes comes up in our regulations for nonprofit organizations, because we do have restrictions on how much a nonprofit organization can engage in gaming activity and how many days a week. And part of those restrictions relate to avoiding the nonprofit organization from being deemed a casino or from the premises being conducted primarily for gaming. I'd like to talk a little bit about the two distinctions between charitable gaming and social gaming, because sometimes people want to confuse them and sort of mix and match provisions from each, and that's not really allowed under the law. So charitable gaming is one of the few exceptions against the general prohibition against gambling. And under the charitable gaming exception, charities can conduct certain types of games, including bingo raffles and Monte Carlo events, and they're permitted to keep a portion of the proceeds of those games. So the law allows charities to use, or nonprofits to use, gaming as a fundraising mechanism. And this nonprofit gaming exception is available exclusively to nonprofits, and the law requires that they have had tax-exempt status for 1 year in order to engage in nonprofit gaming. And the other exception that we've been talking about is social gaming. Social gaming can be allowed in private homes, and also if there's a county or city ordinance that enables social gaming can occur in public places or clubs, including nonprofit premises, if it's played consistent with the ordinances that exist. So a nonprofit organization has two avenues to pursue if they want to be involved in this sort of activity. One, they could come under the charitable gaming exception, which is regulated by our office, and which they could use some of the gaming proceeds to fund their nonprofit activities. Or some organizations, primarily fraternal organizations, offer some forms of social gaming. They allow that to occur on their premises because it's a benefit to their membership, and it enables the membership to engage in that kind of social activity. But if those nonprofits are, if they're falling under the social gaming exception, they're not permitted to take any house income. As you just heard, all the social gaming provisions do not allow for nonprofits to benefit from, financially benefit from those social games. In addition, to the extent that nonprofits are engaged in social gaming as opposed to charitable gaming. Our office, as it stands now, does not have jurisdiction over that situation unless there, sometimes there are charitable appeals made in connection with social gaming, and our office will be involved in focusing on those charitable appeals. But if there's no charitable appeal going on, the social gaming falls under the jurisdiction of the city or county that has the enabling ordinance where that type of activity is permitted. To talk a little bit about the regulation of charitable gaming, the nonprofit organizations are only permitted to engage in the games that have been legislatively authorized, which include bingo raffles and Monte Carlo games. Monte Carlo games were added in approximately 1998 by the legislature. At the time, they only included what we call house-banked games, so poker was not permitted. But in 2005, there was a legislative amendment that allows nonprofit organizations to include poker or other player games as part of a Monte Carlo event. But in order to do that, nonprofits can engage in a minimal amount of gaming activity. There's certain monetary thresholds, in order to generate significant sums of money, they come to our office for a license. We do some background investigation on the organization and the people that are going to be involved in that, in operating the games. They're required to maintain detailed records and documents about the types of gaming revenues that are coming in, the prize payouts and the expenses, and they're also file periodic reports with our office about their revenues and expenses. As a condition of obtaining a nonprofit gaming license, they must allow inspection of the premises, and we do occasionally go in and conduct inspections of licensed gaming organizations. There's also regulations pertaining to how the games operate. In general, the regulations serve to allow charities or nonprofits to benefit from this popular form of activity while limiting the potential for serious gambling or for for-profit interests to take advantage of the exception. For example, in the case of Monte Carlo games, there's a limit to $200 as a buy-in for the event. There are no cash prizes are allowed, so there can only be non-cash prizes. And as I mentioned earlier, any organization is limited to 15 of these type of events per year, and no more than 40 events can be held at a single location. So that gives kind of an overview of the current status of charitable gaming regulation.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Kenimer?
I guess last week after reading the January 22nd, 2010 Department of Justice, I put in a call to you, Mr. Sugarman, and I guess the big questions that I have is what was the stimulus for doing this? And then secondly, given that the conclusions are so extraordinarily clear, why was there not a team effort with the Department of Justice and the DAs and law enforcement to intervene? Because clearly there is inappropriate activity going on according to your own document.
Chair Garrett, Representative Kenimer, to start a little bit with the impetus for this, and there's a pretty good explanation, sort of the history legislatively of why this happened on pages 10, 11, and 12 of the opinion, but just to give an overview, gambling was criminalized. It had been criminalized at common law, but that was codified. And
then there was a desire around that time that the legislature carve out people that were just sort of playing with their friends that were engaged in professional gambling. When that happened, as I mentioned earlier, it shut out a lot of businesses that had had card rooms for a long time where people would just sit back there, they'd gamble, I presume they'd smoke back then too, and drink, and that was what the bar hosting establishment got out of it. They'd sell you beer, they'd sell you food. And so then they tried to open that up a little bit by allowing 25% to come of revenue to that establishment to come explicitly from gambling from covers or whatever, and that didn't work. It brought a flood of, or at least the legislative history suggests it brought a flood of organized gambling into Portland in particular. So then they required after that that the hosting establishment remove itself completely from any direct monetary interest in these games, which is where we're at now. In terms of why there has not been an organized multi-agency or multi-jurisdictional push for enforcement against this, I can't give a particularly complete answer. We have not, as far as I know, I've heard rumors that actually there have been actions in the past based on a sufficient magnitude of complaints, but I will say that if I were to insert a note of ambiguity into this, that every one of these were licensed by somebody, and that because that's a prerequisite in how this is structured. A municipality actually has to authorize it, and I think that that can create by itself some ambiguity. I mean, I understand that the opinion reads as clear, but there are some issues here that could warrant some legislative attention. So I don't know if that's a complete answer, but it's what
Well, it's not, but I don't know how you get much.
Can I just add, Chair Garrett, Representative Kinnemer, I spoke with the folks at the City of Portland who do issue these social gaming permits, and they believed that they were issuing the social gaming permits, you know, kind of in good faith, and that people were going to follow their ordinances. And I think at this point they are looking for some legislative direction from us, because they're kind of like, well, we might have opened a box, and we don't know how to shut it, and we don't know how to solve it.
Okay. Are there further questions? We have a lot of testimony to get through, so if not, I want to thank the panel for being here.
Thank you.
Is Representative Barton still here?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for waiting. I'm going to close the public hearing temporarily on House Bill 3518. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3524. Representative Barton and Mr. Woods. And Mr. Daughter's Cats. And we that's all the testimony on this bill. Then we'll go back to 3518.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Garrett and members of the House Committee on Rules. I'm Brent Barton. I represent Oregon House District 40. I suspect that perhaps you're running somewhat behind schedule, Mr. Chair. And with
I didn't think we would be, but we are.
With your permission, I will try to confine my remarks to under 5 minutes.
That would be great. Thank you.
So allow me to divide my testimony into three parts. First, I'd like to outline the problem that this bill is attempting to address. Second, I'd like to talk briefly about the bill itself. It's actually quite simple. And third, I'd like to talk about and address some of the potential problems with this approach that have been raised. Some legitimate, some less so, and I'd like to talk about what, if anything, we can do about that. So, starting in on part one of that testimony, the problem. The problem that this bill attempts to address is actually quite simple. The costs and the benefits of complying with the rules in major college coaching simply are not aligned. That is to say that the benefits redound to the coach. They are short-term in nature. When I say benefits, I mean of I'll say bending the rules and recruiting rules in NCAA sports. However, the costs tend to be longer term. They tend to be delayed in their implementation, and they tend to redound to the school, the players, and the fans, not the coaches themselves. A few examples of that, I think perhaps the most egregious example would be Pete Carroll of USC. I think John Calipari in men's basketball at the time at Memphis, and potentially Chip Kelly at the University of Oregon. The shoe hasn't quite dropped yet. We don't quite know what that picture is going to look like. So that is the problem. I would note that it's also kind of the hedge fund problem writ small. Anytime you have a mobile labor market, and you have benefits, essentially employees being rewarded for short-term production, but the costs of that conduct are longer-term in nature, so such that the employee is often gone by the time the costs are paid. You have this problem. It's a very, very difficult problem to solve as applied to Wall Street. It's actually relatively simple as applied to college sports, and I think this is one possible way of doing it. So what does this bill do? Essentially, what this bill does is it creates a right of action, either from the university or from the Attorney General, to recover damages plus legal fees from any coach who knowingly or recklessly violates a, quote, major violation of NCAA rules. That is a term of art. That is, I believe, the most severe kind of violation that the NCAA provides for. Now, so that right of action, essentially what that does is that would provide a means of shifting the costs. Remember, we're talking about the costs and the benefits. They're not aligned. And this pattern of coaches misbehaving and then, frankly, being rewarded for it, arguably, as they parlay that short-term success into large professional contracts will repeat until we align them. How do we do it? This just shifts the costs over to the person who derives the benefits, i.e. the coach. Now, there's an amendment before you that will, the bill as drafted is retroactive in nature. That creates a lot of problems, a lot of complications. The amendment before you removes that retroactive clause so that the bill would only be prospective in nature. I hope that also will address a lot of the concerns that have been raised by University of Oregon fans who feel this is targeted specifically at them. But I assure you, Mr. Chair, I would never do such a thing. So that is the bill as written. I think a possible area of clarification as well could be, the bill is written, says actual damages plus fees. I think it would be possible to tighten that up. Such, for example, the University of Oregon has currently spent, just according to the Oregonian, just under $160,000 in fees. That's one possible, for example, that's a direct damage. Another one could be, if to the extent there are fines levied by the NCAA or scholarships removed, that's another readily quantifiable way. I think if we were to draw the line somewhere in there, that would be appropriate. If we were to move beyond that, it gets a little more speculative. Things like lost revenue, lost bowl revenue. I think that strikes me as a little more problematic. So that is the bill itself. Let me now shift to the final part of my testimony and talk about some of the problems associated with this approach as I see them and why I don't think they should stop us from acting. I think the biggest problem is really twofold. Just about everyone, I think, would agree that this approach would be best implemented nationally, so it was across the board. A state-by-state approach could either A, deter the best coaches from coming to coach in Oregon universities, or B, and in my opinion, actually a more cogent complaint would be that, because I still think we'd get great talent in terms of wanting to come to Oregon schools. However, once here, they might not be competing as aggressively as other conference competitors. That's a legitimate point. Again, it would be better to be done nationally. Having said that, I think this is an interesting approach. It's generated tremendous attention, somewhat to my surprise, and indeed even national discussion. I think Oregon has consistently led the way and been a source of policy innovation. I think we should do that once again right here. There's also a third complaint or criticism that was addressed. At about 2:30, I received a letter from Mr. Donovan, signed by the General Counsel of the University of Oregon and Oregon State. That talks a lot about the Oregon Tort Claims Act. They talk about how the state indemnifies its employees for misconduct. And although the statute's not cited, I believe they're referring to ORS 30.285, subsection 1. That's when the tort claim, the state of Oregon indemnifies employees for misconduct. However, if you look at the last full paragraph on the first page of that letter, they acknowledge subsection 2 of that chapter. And that is, willful or wanton misconduct is not necessarily indemnified by the state of Oregon. This bill, as written, only applies to willful conduct, reckless or knowing conduct. To the extent there's any potential discrepancy, which I don't think there is, between that standard and ORS 30.285, subsection 2, could be easily clarified. So I respect, with all due respect to those learned counsel, I think that argument is inapposite. Having said that, though, that is my testimony. I hope it kept another 5 minutes, Mr. Chair.
I don't think you did, but it was a nice effort.
About seven. Pretty good.
Gentlemen, we'll hear from you and then take questions, and I'll just ask you to try and be brief because we're under some time constraints here. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mike. Chair Garrett, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to speak in support of this legislation. My name is Sam Daughters-Katz, and I'm the second-year law student at the University of Oregon, and I'm the student body president-elect for the school. I was also an undergraduate several years ago at the University of Oregon, and in my senior year served as student body president then. I wanted to begin by speaking to the immensely beneficial role of collegiate athletics in a public university. While athletics may not seem to be a critical component of the core mission of research and education, the fact is college athletics play an incredibly important and crucial role in major public universities. Our former president, Richard LeRivière, used to say that athletics are the front porch of our university. I think that's a very accurate way to put it. Athletics help attract the attention of people from around this state, this region, and even this nation, many of whom would not otherwise be interested in what we do at the University of Oregon. Collegiate athletics energizes donors, it helps move capital campaigns, and it helps reinforce regional and national alumni networks. For students, collegiate athletics is a unifying force that helps build community. But at the end of the day, perhaps the greatest thing that athletics provides for students is a diversion. It is a diversion from the reality that faces us every day. To be blunt, the state of affairs for college students in 2013 is worse than it has ever been, and it is not just college students who are suffering on our campus. With dwindling funding and the difficulty of fundraising in these economic times, I can honestly say that the university administration is working miracles in the way we are able to do so much with so little. Yet as all you legislators know, when it comes to public resources, every dollar counts. This bill is not about Chip Kelly. This bill is not about finger pointing, and it's certainly not about disparaging or singling out the University of Oregon. I know that there is no one more committed to an athletic department that plays by the rules on and off the field than the athletic department and our university administration itself. This bill is about leadership, responsibility, and accountability from the top down. It is an unorthodox and innovative approach that would put Oregon out in front of a national issue. But is that not the Oregon way? This legislature has a history advancing the national dialogue on important issues by passing intrepid legislation such as this. To be clear, as Representative Barton spoke to, the eventual goal and more perfect outcome is federal legislation that reinforces this important idea on every campus in every state in the country. But that does not mean that we should not pass this bill now. It is the right way to go, to innovate and to lead, because that is the Oregon way. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today, and after we're done, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thanks very much.
Representative Garrett, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Troy Wood. I'm a citizen of the state of Oregon, a college football fan, and a major Duck fan. So that's why I wanted to come and give my support to House Bill 3524. The only thing that I wanted to add to the discussion is that I think that the bill as drafted applies only to coaches, and I think that if you look at the sanctions that have been imposed by the NC2A over the last 30 years, it has not, those major violations have not always applied to just coaches. They have applied to administrators, they have applied to major boosters of the university. And I think that this bill should apply to anyone that was, you know, maybe you cut it off at administrators or boosters or something of that nature, but there should be an ability to make people jointly and severally liable for the economic damages created by these major violations. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
thank you very much.
If I may just acknowledge Mr. Wood, a friend of mine, fellow football fan. It was his idea for what ultimately became this bill. I just wanted to acknowledge that so that the hate mail can start to go to him.
Have you spoken to the representatives from the universities about their concerns?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. No, I would not say officially, just in passing in the hall. In terms of an actual articulation of concerns,
okay.
The first I saw it was in the letter at 2:30.
Which I got around the same time, so just wonder if any conversation happened. Any questions?
I'd be happy to do so.
Representative Barnhart.
I'm looking at lines 18 through 23 of the bill, and it appears that this purports to apply to events that occurred before the bill is adopted?
Mr. Chair,
or have I misread that in some way?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, you read that correctly. This bill, as drafted there, those lines would make it retroactive, which is confusing and potentially problematic constitutionally, potentially. The Dash A1 amendments in front of you remove that language and make it prospective in nature, which should remove any constitutional question whatsoever.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one other question. To the extent that, well, let me just be direct about it. The things that you've put in this bill, don't they already constitute a cause of action under common law or under statutory law in the state of Oregon already?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, I don't believe that they do. To the extent there's ever been a common law action brought against a coach for a quote-unquote major violation of NCAA rules, I've certainly never heard about it. I'm pretty sure it's never been done. If it had been done, frankly, I don't think we'd see this pattern of coaches doing it and then effectively benefiting from them.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, the point I guess I'm trying to make is that while I certainly agree it's unlikely that the Blackstone was at all aware of NCAA rules, the reality is that the violation of the rule causes damage to the university or the organization, and that results in loss. And if it was done in a way that was reckless or intentional, it would seem to me that's already covered by existing tort law.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, I don't mean to quibble with you. I think of myself as a creative lawyer. I certainly have never thought of that. I don't believe it's ever been done. And respectfully, I simply don't think it is covered under existing common law.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
And, Representative, do you have a sense whether the ever more infamous contract clause of the state constitution would be implicated by this? As in, if there's an indemnification provision, any kind of failure to address within a contract or addressal within a contract, any sense of whether this would implicate that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, that is a great question, and that's the hardest
talk about
question,
that.
Actually. Okay. I think it would certainly be, the contract clause would be right up at the center, but for the Dash 1 amendment. Okay. With the Dash 1 amendment such that this is prospective in nature, I think potential contract clause concerns are significantly reduced, if not eliminated. That's my thought anyway. Having said that, I've been wrong before on such matters.
Representative Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Barton, thank you for bringing this forward. And a very interesting approach to a serious problem. And I wonder, though, if another way of getting at this would be through the contracts that the individual universities enter into with their coaches. And I wonder, you know, it would make sense to me if I were an athletic director or if I were a university president to want to see the contract that I entered into with my football coach, you know, to have this kind of standard to make sure that they behaved well when they were part working for my university. So, potentially another approach to dealing with this would be through the State Board of Higher Education or Higher Education Coordinating Commission or whatever is the appropriate body dealing with, overseeing the programs of all the state universities. Because this would only apply to, actually this is a question, would this just apply to public universities or would it also include private universities?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dembrough, thank you for the, I think, very thoughtful question. Actually, two questions. First of all, to the easier one, yes, as written, I believe this will only apply to public universities. But to, I think, what your real question is, yes, this fundamental problem could be addressed via contract, I believe. At least I can't see why it wouldn't. This approach, as drafted, would essentially create a statutory cause of action against the coach. However, there's nothing right now in the law anywhere to provide that this could be contracted for such that if a coach then committed the violation, there would be a breach of contract action. That sounds like a more elegant approach to me. Having said that, I'm not aware of that it's ever been done before and such. Frankly, were this already a standard clause in coaching contracts, again, I don't think we'd be here. Unfortunately, it's not, and so I think this action is needed.
If I can add one thing to that, Representative Garrett and Representative Dembro, again, I think the problem goes beyond just the coach. That's where all our eyes are focused on right now because of Mr. Tressel in Ohio State and Mr. Kelly and the gentleman from USC, I forgot his name. But anyhow, again, I think that boosters historically have been the greatest offenders of major violations of the NC2A.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe an unsophisticated question, but I'm just curious about the, I guess, definition and how specific it is of intentionally committing or causing to commit something really is, and if there's any vagaries in that, will it tend to make coaches or other administrators shy away from recruiting at all?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holby, first of all, isn't this kind of fun? We got to talk about football. No, Representative Barhart shaking his head.
I'm just worried about my next coach.
So first of all, the terms used are terms of art. They are existing terms in tort law. That negligent, gross negligence, or recklessness is the next step. Knowing, purposeful. Those are the terms that are used in the law. So I think that actually the terms, as used legally speaking, are pretty specific, pretty clear as to what they mean. Now, of course, should an action ever be brought, it would have to be. I think it would only be worthwhile if it was pretty clearly an intentional act. I can't imagine that the state of Oregon would waste its time in litigation unless there was pretty good evidence there. But that's a question for the courts. It's a fact-by-fact question, as I see it.
Any further questions for this panel? Thank you very much for an interesting discussion. Coincidentally, three of our members are from Eugene.
I noticed
Eugene,
that, Chair.
So creates interesting problems, doesn't it? So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3524.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Creative community.
Look forward to possible future discussions of this. Okay, we have one bill to finish hearing. We've got about 15 witnesses on that. We only have three people total on our other two bills. So I'm going to do those next and thank everybody for their patience. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3522. Mr. Schnabel, please come up if you're ready. We'll do this quickly, and we'll do the next one quickly, and go back to our poker room bill.
And Mr. Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 3522 authorizes practitioners to electronically transmit prescriptions for Schedule II controlled substances in non-emergency situations. There's an emergency clause on this measure. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact on the measure.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy. And I want to thank you for hearing the bill today. I will do this in less than 5 minutes.
Thank you.
I promise. I apologize for not getting around to see any of you beforehand to explain the bill. I understand that you got a brief statement from the Pharmacy Coalition, and I saw that. I think that's a pretty accurate statement about the bill. It's a very simple bill. I'll give you a brief background about electronic prescribing. Electronic prescribing of prescription drugs that are not controlled substances is mainstream. It's common. Almost everybody is doing it now. The electronic prescribing of prescription drugs that are controlled substances is not mainstream because it's been prohibited by the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. And as a result of that, most states in their Controlled Substances Act had similar prohibitions because it's prohibited federally. Recently, the DEA has decided they will allow electronic prescribing of controlled substances under certain circumstances, and it has to do with the software and hardware systems that the prescribers and the pharmacies will be using. Some of those software systems now are getting up to speed where they will be able to use them, and so states have been going through their statutes and rules to eliminate any barriers to the electronic commerce, electronic prescribing, and we have done the same. But in a recent review of our Controlled Substances Act, I found this one line that still is a prohibition to electronic prescribing of Schedule II controlled substances specifically, and we're asking that you approve this bill and move it forward to eliminate that prohibition so that we'll be consistent with federal law. 4 minutes.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
So marijuana is in Oregon a Schedule II controlled substance, federally I think still Schedule I, and so would a marijuana prescription thus be permissible to be transmitted electronically pursuant to this bill because we passed it here in Oregon, or would it still be prohibited by, or would the federal scheduling ratings still prohibit that kind of transmission of electronic record?
My understanding is that it wouldn't apply to marijuana at all because, first of all, marijuana isn't prescribed. It's recommended by the physician. So there would not be a prescription to be electronically transmitted.
Any further questions?
Representative Berger. Yes, I have a number of questions, probably not of this testifier. I sit on the Rules Committee. I am not an expert in either pharmacological or transmissional or health care or Schedule II drugs, and yet I am being asked to, based on this nice gentleman's testimony, to move a bill that would authorize something I don't even understand, and based on this very brief testimony. So, and it is also late in the session, and this is a late numbered bill, so I'm asking myself, why is this being rushed before me? And maybe you can answer that, Mr. Chair. What's the hurry? Why are we doing it now? Exactly how do you transmit these, and why suddenly we need this authority when a month ago this could have gone through a committee that is more expert in this type of activity?
That's a good question. I don't particularly know how this bill ended up in our committee, and I think that's worth finding out more about. So I'm going to suggest we not move the bill today.
Thank you.
Have some further discussion. Any further questions for this witness? All right. Mr. Schnabel, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3522. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3519. Mr. Barrows, Mr. Bryan.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3519 permits insurer under specified conditions to post insurance policy and endorsements on insurer's website in lieu of mailing or delivering insurance policy and endorsements to insured. This measure has no revenue nor does it have a fiscal impact.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows. I represent Progressive Insurance Company, an automobile insurer, and we bring this bill to you today. With me is Kenton Bryan, who is the regional government relations person for the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, and he's been working on this bill in other states, so he will explain the bill, which is basically subsection 3 of the bill, and I just want to say quickly that subsection 1 and 2 of this bill is strictly a legislative council's redo under their new manual of how they write bills. It is existing law unchanged. It looks like a gobbledygook, but it is not. And so Mr. Bryan, Mr. Chairman, will explain subsection 3, which is the bill.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kenton Bryan. I'm the Assistant Vice President for the Northwest Region of the Property Casualty Insurers Association. We're a national trade association of property casualty insurance companies writing in all states. We represent about 43, our members represent about 43% of the auto insurance policies in force in Oregon today. Very briefly, this is a fairly straightforward, simple piece of legislation that would allow insurers to provide policy and endorsement information that is not specific to a single policyholder but is generic in nature and post that information on a publicly available website and notify the policyholder of where to find that information as opposed to sending it to the paper copy to them in the mail. It allows the insured to opt out of that, and if they don't wish to obtain the information electronically, don't have the ability to do that, there will be information provided to them in the statute about how to ask for the information the old-fashioned way, and the carrier will provide it to them at no charge. This is kind of a third leg of a stool. Oregon has already enacted electronic delivery legislation that allows insurers to conduct business with their insureds electronically. And earlier this session, the Oregon legislature approved legislation that allows an insurer to provide to their insured and the insured to provide to a law enforcement officer proof of insurance electronically through an app on their smartphone. So this is legislation along those lines, and I'm happy to commend it to you. Can I answer any questions?
Thank you very much. And Representative Berger, this bill is here because I introduced it on behalf of Mr. Barrows. So.
Thank you, Mr. I think I scored one on that.
Good catch.
Okay, so page 2, line 3 says, archive expired policies and endorsements for 5 years after the policies expire and make archive policies available upon request. And some of us now know from hearing earlier in the day that, for example, a lawsuit on a property can be levied more than 5 years. I think it's a 10-year statute of limitations. And so what if, what I'm asking ultimately is, would this scenario that I'm about to describe still be doable? So electronic version of policy made available to the consumer. It goes into a new form and gets archived for 5 years. And then 6 years after the time of the policy, somebody needs to go back because a lawsuit is impending and review what was in the insurance policy. So does the language archive expired policies and endorsements for 5 years and make available upon request mean that only within the 5 years do they have to keep the archive and after that it gets deleted? Because then, it wouldn't even match the statute of limitations is what I'm saying. And we'll never know it was actually in the policy because it was electronic.
I wouldn't want to say, in the first place, of course, this would be the minimum. Some carriers may choose to keep their records longer than that. I don't know the answer to that question. I would have to inquire about that. I also don't know whether current law requires written policies that are currently provided to the insured and kept by the insured to be maintained longer than that. What I'd like to do is get back to you and provide you an answer to that question.
Okay. That'd be great.
Please. You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
I do. Yes. And please send that to the whole committee, or to our staff, and she'll distribute it to the committee members.
Can do.
Any further questions? Representative Holby. Oh.
Just a question about the consumer that chooses not to get it electronically. You're then advising that consumer or the insured that they have a right to request it and obtain a copy without charge and giving them instructions for making that request. Wouldn't it be simpler? It seems like you're making the consumer go through a couple of different hoops there. If they say they don't want to receive it electronically, why wouldn't you just mail it to them instead of making them go through this series of requests?
Mr. Chairman,
am I missing something there?
Representative Hovey, no company has to do this, number one. And they post on the website and they tell the insured where that website is and how they can get to it, and it's all the boilerplate stuff. Anything that's, you purchase insurance, anything that's personal to you gets mailed to you. Included in that document or a separate document in that mailing is a number to call and say, I want a printed insurance policy. Why Progressive is interested in this is the chief executive officer of the company went to a conference about how to make the insurance industry more environmentally friendly. And as a result of that, he came up with the idea of this is a way to save a lot of paper is to not send automatically the thick packet of paper that I'm venture to say most of us have not read entirely our insurance policies. That's the genesis of this. And
I understand that.
It does show, Representative Hovey, on the declaration page that talks about your specific information, the policy that you've purchased, or on a page attached to it.
Okay, thanks.
Say you can call this 800 number and we'll mail you a copy of the whole thing. Or you can, if you have the computer capability, print it out at no cost. And here's the site to, here's how you do that.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Please go ahead.
As I understand the language of sub B, under sub D. This is not a two-step process. It's a one-step process. The instructions are included in or a document that accompanies the declarations page, which is the document that is personalized to you that you would continue to receive in writing at the time your policy is sold to you or shortly thereafter provided to you by the insurer. So the instructions are there included when you get the deck page. You get the instructions on how to get your policy form in writing if you so choose, as well as where to find it on the internet if you so choose.
Further questions? Thank you both. Sounds like we have some follow-up work to do on this one, but we'll
Thank
wait
you.
To hear back from you. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3519. We'll now return to our public hearing on House Bill 3518. We have a number of folks who've waited patiently to speak, and we're down to about our last half hour, so I'm going to ask folks to limit their testimony to about 2 minutes. I know some of you have submitted written testimony. If you've done so, I would ask that you not read your testimony to us. There's no need to do that. It's part of the record, and you're welcome to summarize, paraphrase the testimony if you wish. Our first panel will be Tom Rask, KJ Hinton, and John, can't quite read it, but it looks like Bachmeyer.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Parrish's diligent staff emailed me the Attorney General's opinion. We have posted, and I have emailed it to you all as well. So you should, and I do have hard copies as well. If you are can't have problems reading it or accessing it.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Tom Rask. I was mentioned earlier by Representative Parrish as somebody who brought this issue to her attention. I represent MT&M Gaming, who operates a gaming facility in La Center, Washington. Over 25% of our employees work here, are Oregonians who pay taxes, who have workers' compensation. I'll note for the record that I've submitted my written testimony, and so therefore, pursuant to Chairman's request, I will highlight a few things that I think are important to understand. And I'll pick up really initially with what Representative Kenmer pointed out, which is I appreciate his frank question to the Department of Justice. The law is very clear. The law is absolutely clear. Under the social gaming statute, there is no house income of any kind, indirect or direct. Very straightforward. The Attorney General's opinion simply gave you the summary of the legislative history, which I think is very critical. I laugh. We all learn how things kind of come full circle. The 73 session allowed a foot in the tub of a little bit of gaming. And what happened? They had to come back within a year and say, wait a second, this is out of control. We've now got professional gambling in Portland. Therefore, we're going to go back to what had been the law for some time, which was no house income, period. That is the law today. What's really happened is you have licensees, as was mentioned by the Department of Justice, the local jurisdictions are allowed to create a social gaming ordinance. And what you had in Portland, and this is really where the problem originated, is Portland created an ordinance and then didn't know what to do. Didn't reach out to lawyers, didn't reach out to the legislature, didn't reach out to DOJ. I think the question was asked, you know, what about enforcement? Why wasn't somebody involved? And what you have now are illegal gaming facilities. Straightforward, no question about it. It is illegal to charge a cover charge. It's illegal to pay for the chips. It's illegal to pay any employees. It's illegal to do anything for a profit. Simply stated. Now, we all, I think, you can look at that problem and say, well, is it enforcement? Is it the law? What are we going to do about it? And that's why it's here now before you. This problem is expanding. Tigard is considering an ordinance. Beaverton is considering an ordinance. So the legislature needs to act. I think Representative Parrish said it well. The city of Portland has acknowledged there's now a problem and they don't know what to do. And that's their own words from the director of revenue who issued these licenses. They don't know what to do. Well, the simple answer is this bill, because this bill is actually the middle ground. We could have come before the committee and said, well, let's just get rid of social gaming. That would eliminate the problem. No house income, no gaming, no problem. But we didn't do that because there's a role for social gaming. There's a reason why people like to get together and play poker at the Elks or play it in their house with their friends. There's a role to play. And the middle ground answer is to eliminate what is the problem. The problem is the profit motive. The reason these clubs have sprung up, and as Representative Parrish handed out pictures, you're walking into a casino. They use the words casino, you walk in, there's nothing there but tables to play at. That's what it is. It's a casino. Why? Because they're making a profit. There was one of these clubs for sale on Craigslist. How can you sell a business that can't make any money? By statute. Okay, very simple. By allowing charities, fraternal, and religious organizations to do it, they're going to follow the law. So the middle ground is to say, okay, we're still going to allow social gaming in some type of controlled method where a charity that's got a 501c status to worry about losing and tax returns to file and employees to pay for is going to follow the law. So if the Elks want to get together, or if a religious organization wants to get together, or a charitable organization wants to get together and have a social gaming event or even location, this bill would allow them to do that. As the representative of the DOJ testified, there's two tracks for charities to do gaming. And so you could, by changing the law, it's fixing the problem. You're taking the profit motive out, and that's really what's driving
us. All right.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you. Gentlemen, again, please try and keep it to about 2 minutes.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, I'm K.J. Hinton of Fifth Avenue Consulting, and I'm testifying. I'm here on behalf of two card rooms from La Center, Washington, and I'm here to speak in favor of the bill. I was brought in to study the card room situation with a view towards expansion into the market by my clients' businesses. I visited approximately 20 of these establishments since August of 2010 up to about 3 months ago, some of them repeatedly. And at almost 100% of these locations, I observed the following. Every location was cash only. Players were all required to pay a cover charge of at least $10 each to enter the facility to play. Dealers were tipped, usually at the end of every tournament, by the players finishing in the money, about 10% or so. On at least one occasion, I observed a dealer being paid directly by the manager of the facility I was in out of the bank envelope where the money, the rebuys, the buy-ins, and add-ons typically goes as a part of the tournament. Receipts. Dealers in cash games are typically tipped by the player who won the hand, each hand that they're held. I've held discussions with the manager of one of these establishments where he described to me in exacting detail holding cash games behind locked doors, that 500 people in his establishment per week was not unusual. That he had, that his owner had installed house players, that the players paid or chipped up to stay in the game, and that the player would get a percentage of the winnings. This was in direct violation. They'd rake money from the rebuys, since rebuys are practically impossible for a player to keep track of. Because what you've got is several players around a room making a rebuy, and you're focusing on your cards, and there's just no way you can see what's going on behind you and who's buying what. So you're looking at the tournament director board, which is supposed to keep track of all of this, and you're just trusting that the numbers that you're seeing are representative of the amounts of money that have actually been taken in for the tournament. The example would be if there were 14 rebuys in a tournament, only 10 would be shown on the board, and the house would keep the four rebuys and keep those four rebuys out of the pot, so the players who are supposed to get all of the money from the entirety of the game would find that their actual winnings would be reduced. Towards the end of my visits, open cash games with large amounts of money on the tables for players not in tournaments became the norm. They started out slowly, kind of like a tiptoe approach, and then they exploded everywhere. Every organization, every facility I went to had them. If you weren't in a tournament, the cash game was open. It's under a sit-and-go kind of environment where they typically have a fixed time limit of, say, an hour. You sit in, you play for an hour, and then you're cashed out.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up, but we do have your written testimony here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know that had been submitted.
Yeah, it was submitted.
So ultimately, I've studied the problem. I've studied the situation for 3 years completely with an eye towards my client's expansion into the market, with an inability to engage in that expansion because the Washington State Gaming Commission has determined that there's questionable legality involved. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll hear from our third person, and then we'll take questions. Please go ahead.
Chairman Garrett, committee and staff, my name is John Bachmeyer. I, too, am here representing the Cardinals of La Center. I will be brief. Excuse me. Approximately 2 years ago, my clients asked me to do extensive research into the poker room phenomenon of Portland. Over the past 2 years, I've met with at least 20, if not 25, different officials from city, state, federal government, trying to learn more about what was going on, trying to find out if it was legal or illegal. I met with members of the Portland Police Department, the specific officer assigned to social gaming. He told me directly that he was obviously aware of the illegal activity and he had brought it forth to the assistant deputy prosecuting attorney, and that they simply didn't have an interest or resources in pursuing this, but there was never a question of whether or not it was illegal. I also spoke with representatives of the Washington State Gambling Commission, where my clients are under their jurisdiction, and we talked to them about expanding into Portland, and they told us directly they were very concerned about our license in Washington State with regards to coming into Oregon under this current social gaming model. I'll also share with you real quickly that I've been involved in gaming as a player, a manager, a shareholder, and now a consultant for over 20 years. I have never in my life, in 10 different states I've worked in, seen anything like the current social gaming model you have here. The poker clubs in Oregon have been unregulated for 2 years. Players are exchanging hundreds of thousands of dollars. A few days ago, a gentleman won almost $10,000. I wish I was that gentleman. But the fact is, there's no tax structure. There's no background investigations. There's no surveillance. There's no structure you would find in any gaming facility anywhere in this country or around the world. And one of the things that's concerning to folks who do like to game or are in the business is having a business that is regulated and run correctly. So I'll end there and keep
thank
it brief
you.
And say thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you for that. Any questions for this panel? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why would your company have any interest in expanding into Oregon if to operate legally you can't make a profit? There's a background piece of this
sure.
that I am completely missing.
Sure, let me answer that, Representative. Initially, there were some questions about what the law was, and until we did the research and reached out to the city of Portland and identified the Attorney General's opinion, it became very clear we could not come here. But because we saw this massive expansion of gaming and wondered aloud, what's the situation? How are people doing $50,000 tournaments when there's the city ordinance says no more than $1 per player per game total? It is completely against the law. And so we've concluded we cannot come here.
I think you answered my question in your first sentence.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Eric Dorsheimer, Jeff Sugarman, and Roy Thorpe.
I guess Eric's not going to testify.
Okay. Then Steve Rosenbaum, want to come forward? Thanks for waiting.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Jeff Sugarman. I represent Save Oregon Poker, a political action committee I and several players formed a couple of weeks ago. I am also very honored to be here today representing some of the owners of the poker clubs in Portland. And I do think it's fascinating, as Rep. Barnhart pointed out, that a group of individuals representing card rooms to the state, to our neighbors to the north, are here today trying to shut down legitimate gaming operations here in Portland. I want to mention a couple of other things, too. There's been a lot of talk over the last few days about illegal activities by both owners of the clubs and by players. These folks are not felons or misdemeanants. They're operating under a statute that allows cities to license and regulate private businesses. They've never been raided, arrested, shut down, or even cited, and there's never been a court case. There's even a sign outside one of the clubs I played in last week that says the premises is under surveillance by the Portland Police Department. Stating that these club owners are committing felonies calls into question the dozens of cities that allow them to operate, the police departments of those cities, the Department of Justice, and the state police. I have played in close to 100 tournaments in a number of these clubs. I have never seen anything that even closely resembles a fight, and the only law enforcement, aside from security, that the clubs hire to be at those clubs are law enforcement officers who are off-duty and playing in the clubs, and there are plenty of them that do that. I also want to address an issue that came up as to whether or not these are, quote, casinos. A casino-like or casino style does not mean the same thing as casino. When I wake up in the morning and I do my cat stretch, it doesn't mean I'm a cat. Casino style merely means that clubs offer a game similar to the poker game that's offered in casinos. These clubs have no slot machines, they have no video poker machines, and they offer no table games where the house has an advantage. As I think you heard from the Department of Justice today, in the early 1970s, there were a series of statutes put into law, amended again, and then finally amended again. In the DOJ opinion, too, I find the legislative history section most revealing that the legislature just continually fought over this for 4 years and then basically abandoned those statutes and have left them in pretty much of a muddled mess. Even the Department of Justice opinion points out several serious flaws in the current social gaming statutes, and you can read about some of those in my testimony. The last thing that the legislature did, though, was add 167.121, which was the local authorization of social games, allowing cities and counties by ordinance to license these businesses. And it is that section of law that 3518 seeks to amend. From a construction standpoint alone, I think this bill is flawed. If you look above 121 in the statute to 167.118, that's the section that talks about charitable gaming, religious organizations, and fraternal organizations. By amending 167.121 and replacing the words private clubs and private businesses with fraternal, charitable, and religious organizations, I think what this bill really does is set up a new layer of bureaucracy that would require or could require all of those organizations to then license themselves with the cities that have ordinances while at the same time closing down these private clubs. So I think it adds another layer of regulation to these clubs, and I'm pretty sure that's not what the drafters of the bill intended.
Jeff, we have your testimony in writing. We're not going to have time for you to read the rest of it. So can you bring it to a conclusion so we can get through everybody else?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think this is what I'd like to say. This state has changed greatly since the 1970s when these statutes were written. We have casinos that offer gambling, we have state-run lottery, and we have literally thousands of restaurants and bars across the state that profit from gambling in the state every single day. These statutes are antiquated, and they need to be upgraded, and we are willing to engage in that process. But the truth is that these clubs have employees, they have rent, they have leases, they have they provide a very safe and secure outlet for people who like me who enjoy gaming and enjoy poker. And these clubs pay taxes both on their profits and their employees. They follow the rules as they believe they have been established, and they are nothing if not smart business owners who saw a market opportunity and went to work. We should be applauding and helping their entrepreneurial spirit, not trying to shut them down. And players like myself and the club owners are willing to engage in a process where we can find solutions to this and come back to this legislature next session with a model that would allow them to continue to operate similar to the clubs that are operating to the north of us, and
and bring these statutes into 2013. And I thank you for your time.
Hello. Chair Garrett and members of the committee, my name is Roe Thorpe, and I live in Portland, and I've been a social justice activist for over 25 years, and I have spoken to many of you in the past about very different issues. But in addition to my concern about social justice, I'm also a very avid, although not always successful, poker player, and I play quite a bit. I play quite a bit of recreational poker. And I guess, I'm not going to read my testimony. I do want to just respond to a couple of things that I heard. I guess I would say, first of all, that what draws me to poker is a few things. I mean, one is there's an incredible diversity in the community of poker players that I've encountered. I've been playing for about 5 years, seriously. And I never in Oregon come across such a mix of people from every walk of life, totally racially mixed. There could be more women playing, but one of the things that makes women feel comfortable in playing is that these clubs feel very safe. You feel very taken care of, and it feels to me like there is a level of transparency in the way that the money is dealt with and the way that the buy-ins are dealt with that's really comforting. So there are big screens all around the rooms in all of the places that I've played that show clearly what the buy-ins are. They show the rebuys. Rebuys are shouted out. This idea that they are hidden to me is I don't quite see how that happens. You'd have to not be paying attention. And they're actually very reasonable to play tournament poker at these clubs. I have a nonprofit salary, which I seem to have sentenced myself to for the duration of my career. And most of the buy-ins average about $50 for a tournament. And you play, and you know, you've paid like a $5 or $10 cover charge that lasts all day, no matter how many tournaments you play in. And then you pay the tournament buy-in, $50, $60 or so. And then the way that I think we get to a dollar a hand is that actually you play for hours on that $50 or so. And sometimes you're not as lucky, but most of the time skill wins out. And I'm not a table games player. I don't play blackjack. I don't play other casino games. I only play poker. It feels very different to me. For me, it's a test of skill. With a dash of luck, kind of like golf when a breeze comes in. That's what it feels like to me. But it feels very much to me like a game that has done a lot for my life, has built a community of people that I respect and feel a strong part of. And it would be a very sad thing if this bill resulted in that community being harmed by this and what is a serious pastime for many of us being hurt as well.
Thank you very much. Steve.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Steve Rosenbaum. I'm a small business owner in Portland. I live in Northeast Portland. I'm a poker hobbyist. I have no professional interest in poker or commercial interest in poker. I've been playing poker all my life since my grandfather taught me when I was 5 years old. And I used to play in the Le Center casinos. I've played in Las Vegas. I've played lots and lots of poker. The poker rooms in Portland that are licensed by the city of Portland are the best run, most player friendly poker rooms I've been in the world. And I've been in the world's biggest poker rooms. And as from a player perspective, it's an incredibly safe environment. It cost me $10 in house fees to play for 5 hours at Encore. If I go up to Le Center, they're going to charge me probably $70 in house fees for 5 hours of play. If I go to Las Vegas, there's going to be $70 worth of rakes in 5 hours worth of play. So the players in Portland and the players in Eugene and the players in other cities who are playing in these clubs, we're getting an incredible, incredible bargain. And it's not surprising that the casinos in Washington feel threatened, that we don't need to go there anymore. A lot of misconceptions have been put forth calling these clubs casinos. They're not casinos. This is poker is a game of skill. There's no blackjack. In blackjack, you go play blackjack at Le Center, and you can lose $2,000 in an hour. It happens to people all the time. You go to these clubs in Portland, and 90% of the players, the most they lose in 5 hours is $50. On top of that, in terms of the way these clubs are operated, they have consistent staff. That makes us think that it's fair. I've never had any reason to think it's not safe. Once I won a tournament at the Encore, I was issued a W-2G tax form. A security guard escorted me out to my car. These games are regulated under existing law. These clubs are operated really well by people who do it not to make money as much as for the love of the game. And please don't take away our hobby. Don't take away these clubs that are really well run. Let the poker club owners and the poker dealers and the poker players get together and, as Oregonians, work with you guys on a bill next year that will add a little bit of regulation. But right now, it's really not a big problem.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Berger.
Sorry, Mr. That's Chair. Okay. I would like to ask the gentleman, because I have never entered these clubs, a couple of questions about you've confused me a little bit. Poker is a game, and I've played it. I know that. What is a tournament, and how do you distinguish? And when you go to these, are you going to a tournament, or are you going to play a game? And and I'm mixing my questions, so I can be real fast. How many, a typical Portland poker club, how many tables are ongoing, and is it only on Saturday and Sunday, or is it all week long? Those are the kinds of questions.
Before you answer all those questions, let me just say we're coming up at 5 o'clock. We will start losing committee members, but we've got seven or so more folks. We will get to each of you. Again, please keep your testimony brief, and that way we'll be out of here by about 10 or a quarter after. So go ahead.
Okay. In poker, there are two types of poker. One is tournaments, and one is called a cash game. Most of the poker that's being played, at least at Encore where I play, is tournaments. The tournaments are anywhere from two tables of nine players all the way up to 150 players on a Friday night, Saturday night, or a semi-annual large tournament. The tournaments, I believe the average tournament has a buy-in of $50 during the week. The tournament buy-ins range from about $25, and then there's the big tournaments are the $50 tournament Friday night, the $100 tournament Saturday night. The clubs operate from approximately noon until past midnight and have tournament games running 7 days a week.
And if I may add to that, I would just say that what happens is you pay the cover charge, and then what you pay for the tournament buy-in goes into a prize pool, and then that's distributed percentage-wise among the top winners.
Well, I understand gambling,
right.
Really.
And so, and I think the difference, one of the big differences between a tournament and a cash game is that everyone pays the same amount. You get the chips that you get. Everyone has the same amount. So you're not just like losing and losing and losing.
And as poker players, we don't consider poker to be gambling. it's a technical argument.
I've seen rounders.
We believe it's a game of skill.
Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I'll make it kind of brief. So in looking at the laws and things like that, I'm assuming that these poker clubs don't actually make income based on the outcome of any wager or participation in any winnings. They basically charge to cover the expenses of providing the dealer, the room, the facilities. And so their profit isn't based on gambling as such, but just making the opportunity for the players to gamble.
Chair Garrett, Representative Holley, that's exactly correct. All of the money for the entry fees goes back into the prize pool, and that is what makes these different than a casino table game like blackjack, is that there is no house advantage, and the house does not benefit from one player or another winning that tournament.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, panel. David Bowles, Rachel O'Neill, Chris Vetter. Whoever would like to go first, please just state your name.
I'll jump out. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is David Bowles. I'm a native Oregonian, and I have been self-employed since 1978. I currently own a restaurant in Washington County, and I played organized poker for over 35 years. For the last 2 years or so, I played a couple times a week, most typically at the Encore Club in Northwest Portland. My wife doesn't mind that I go and play, gets me out of her hair, and I never put much at stake. I usually play these tournaments that are $25 or $30 entry fees, $40 entry fees during the weeknights. In the years past, I played in Vancouver when they had the card rooms downtown Vancouver, and I played in Le Centre. And I played at Spirit Mountain from time to time. And my experience, what I wanted to speak to was my experience in recent years is completely different than my experiences over the past. There is a camaraderie among the players. There's a hospitable environment, and there is an opportunity to form true friendships. I've never sat in a room with such a diverse group of people. You have young Asian men and women, you have old Asian men and women, you have African Americans, and you have a very broad cross-section of people with whom I have formed true friendships. And there's not any other opportunity to do that and to make those cross-cultural and cross-economic connections. I play with, I have customers from my restaurant who come in and play, and I play with husband and wife, couples who come in and play, and Roger and his wife own a construction business and are opening a sandwich shop in Orenco, and we talk about that. There's Sam, who is a good player, and he works for the state as in Child Protective Services, and he's the one who first called me dad, and that's what they kind of refer to, how they refer to me in the club. I really enjoy the young men and women that I play with. When I read Representative Parrish's comparison to poker rooms and hookah lounges, I thought that the characterization stood reality on its head. I think that poker rooms have proliferated because there's a demand for social connection. There's a demand to spend time doing something besides watching TV. I recognize that there are challenges surrounding this. I've worked in turnaround management and consulting with distressed businesses, and I see how those challenges are there are some fundamental challenges and some gray areas that I think that need to be fixed, so this business model can be corrected. I think that we can correct it in a way that doesn't undermine the opportunity for the social experience and the opportunity for not toss these entrepreneurs who have opened up their businesses honestly in accordance with rules and regulations that are in place, not toss them out of business and cause immeasurable harm.
Thank you, Mr. Bowles. Colleagues, sorry for not mentioning this. We're not going to get to House Bill 2118. We're going to carry that work session over till Monday. We'll do that first thing Monday. Ms. O'Neill.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Rachel O'Neill.
I'm a graduate of Lewis and Clark Law School and a practicing attorney and mom. I am also a poker player, and I primarily play at Encore Club in Northwest Portland. I'm not going to read from my testimony, but just try to hit the highlights here, you know, as we're after 5 o'clock. But just to say that for me, Encore is a place for me to meet people and network, and it's been really great for my professional development. I've got 7 clients from people that I've met at the poker room and made a lot of really good friends. I really appreciate the opportunity to have a place to play where there is security and experienced managers to prevent problems from happening that I've experienced in home games. I'd echo what Rowie said about being escorted by a security guard after winning money there, and I feel very safe in the environment. And I just would like to say that players welcome regulation, and we hope that this would be looked into further and not rushed through, and that we'd like to look at solving the problems rather than taking private business out of the social gaming statute altogether. That really the bill hurts Portland poker players, and I don't see anyone that it benefits except for out-of-state interests. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Vetter.
Chair Garrett and distinguished members of this committee, and Michael Denbro, my old friend, who I've known since college, thank you for listening to us today. Your patience is extraordinary. Day in and day out, you listen to so many people, and we really appreciate this opportunity to come before you and present our side. The story I wanted to tell you today is a personal one. I got a call on April 26th from my friend John O'Guy, who owns the Encore Poker Club. And this is a man who emigrated to the United States to finish his advanced degree at Portland State University. He created several companies. Like many entrepreneurs, he eventually settled on Encore in 2010 and literally invested his life savings in the business.
Give us your name. Did you state your name? I'm sorry.
Christopher Vetter.
Thank you. Okay.
I'm a marketing executive, and I live in Portland. So my friend John O'Guy, who owns Encore, literally invested everything he has in this. And he did it consulting with the city, and his business is licensed and regulated, and he's absolutely complied with every imaginable law. These clubs are not scofflaw, outlaw organizations. There's been a lot of misinformation that has been cast about in this hearing and elsewhere, suggesting that these clubs are somehow illegitimate. And the reality is, every step of the way, these clubs have worked cooperatively with every imaginable level of government to make sure that they're complying with city and local ordinances and state regulations. As with any imperfect service industry, an industry that's evolving or an industry that is based around laws that are decades old, there are imperfections and things that we can work on and things that we can improve. And every single argument that you've heard from the proponents of this bill today, every single one, is the best argument for us not to act on this legislation at this time. Every single compelling argument that has caused you to doubt these poker clubs is a reason for you to extend the life of these clubs so that we can get together, communicate about the process, fix any concerns, in much the same way that you would not close every single restaurant if you heard that one restaurant was serving unsanitary food or that there was an issue with a particular business. You wouldn't condemn an entire industry. You wouldn't shut down every imaginable company or hurt these mostly minority-owned businesses because you had some concerns about the way that they were run or practiced. Most of these concerns are just a result of a need for clarification between the state government and between the city government. And if we commit ourselves to that process and we dialogue about it and communicate about it and come up with proactive solutions that allow these clubs to thrive and succeed and continue to do what they do best, holding together a vibrant, dynamic community of people, then justice is served. People who have invested their life savings in companies and have played by the rules won't be treated unfairly. And the thousands and thousands of Oregonians who enjoy recreational poker because it's stimulating and because it allows them to come together and enjoy one another will live to see another day. Our argument is an argument for fairness. My friend John O'Guy said to me, I don't want to lose everything that I've earned. And we don't want to lose the community that we've built and that we've created together. And that's why I'm asking you with adamance and passion and sincerity to not allow this bill to move forward, to rise up and work with us, take our hand, and work toward better solutions and clarifications of the social gaming laws in the future.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for this panel?
No.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Jacob Branson, Jack Elder, Chuck Richards.
My name is Jacob Branson. I've been called by Tom Rask. 2008, I looked at opening a poker club. I've been involved in casino poker, playing poker for the last 12 years. After taking some time and really looking at the law, I just didn't see any way to make money. I had some other friends who actually opened poker clubs, one's in Dallas, who were making lots of money. So after that, I started looking into how they were making money, which actually brought up a lot of concerns. Being involved in poker, I try to be an advocate for poker. I try to be an advocate for protecting poker as an entity. It's came a long ways from when I first started playing poker. It was kind of thought the smoky back room of a bar, you know, in somebody's basement. You know, you had all these sorts of movies about people getting robbed and money getting stolen. So I had written some things down here that I was going to talk about. After hearing some of the testimony today, I almost kind of feel offended that it's almost like we just say we're not breaking the law and we're just not breaking the law. I know that earlier testimony said the money's almost transparent, how they handle the money's transparent. On one of the websites, it says $2 million in tournament payouts for 2011. I don't think I want that money to be transparent. I kind of want to know where that money went. Did it all get paid out? $2 million is a lot of money for one business to kind of make transparent. I like poker. I love poker. That's why I made it a profession. I think that anything that hurts poker hurts my profession, it hurts my friends, it hurts my family. I actually kind of feel a little bit offended today that none of the business owners showed up. I don't see the owner from Encore here. I don't see the owner from Aces up in Dallas here. I see some players who don't want to lose the club that's 10 minutes away. I don't want to drive an hour either, but if I want to play poker, I have to. If I own a business and I'm deathly afraid to lose my entire life savings, I promise you I'll show up in front of every single one of you if I'm going to lose everything I've ever earned. I'm a free market guy. I think that competition creates the best types of business. It creates the best business. But on the flip side, I don't want to put the citizens of Oregon at risk to lose money. Of course, nobody thinks that anything wrong is going on because you've got $2 million transparent dollars. How do you know anything was wrong is going on? I've worked in casinos, and it is amazing the kind of things you'll see people do that you won't see unless you have 400 cameras in one room. It's just appalling to me, actually, that I did my due diligence. I was going to open a poker club in 2008. I did my due diligence, read the law, and came to the conclusion that I just can't make any money. So I didn't. I heard a post that said, why is it fair to me to run a business for 3 years and then get told you have to shut down because you're not complying with the law? It's part of the business owner's duty to make sure he complies with the law in the first place, not skate by for 3 years and then told you have to get shut down.
Okay, I'm gonna have to stop you there so we can finish up our witnesses. Thank you very much, sir.
Chairman Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Jack Elder. I'm president and CEO of Oregon Sports Action, a nonprofit corporation that operates bingo. We use the money from bingo in our purpose, which is the development of Olympic sport in Oregon. We've been doing that since 1990. We have a bingo license. I'm also chair of the Oregon Charitable Gaming Association, which is a group of bingo game licensees who've gotten together, and we represent the industry when necessary. We haven't had the opportunity to get together to discuss this yet because it came upon us so quickly. I'm speaking for Oregon Sports Action today. I'm speaking in favor of the bill. I believe it's needed. If we were to draw a parallel between poker and bingo, in the 80s, bingo was running rampant as well. In 1988, I believe, is when they passed the law, basically bringing in the Charitable Gaming Act, and basically they put law into the process. Bingo had its abuses. I mean, there were some serious abuses. There was people who were taking money out, employing people who were ghosts. And when the oversight came in, it stopped. You have to remember that bingo is gambling. They call it gaming. They call it charitable gaming. It's gambling. Bingo's gambling, poker's gambling. Both need oversight. There, if you have any number of people there who are working for you and working and playing the game, some way they'll want to game the game so they have a better advantage. You need oversight all the time. Bingo has been trending downward since 1995, since the state of Oregon got into the process and business of gaming. You know, that started with the lottery. We have gone from about 95 Class A licenses down to 25 Class A licenses because of our competitive gaming right now, casinos and the state. I believe right now, with the phenomenon of Texas Hold'em and the way it's gripped the community, that if it's managed, if it's controlled, and it has oversight by the Charitable Activities Division of the Department of Justice, and if you have reporting, and if you have somebody who's watching the game and making you report, as we do every quarter for every penny, it will benefit the people, it will benefit the community, and it will benefit the charitable people who will be operating the games. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Chair, Representative Garrett, Chair and Committee. My name is Chuck Richards. I'm the President of the Oregon Sports Academy. I hold a bingo license with the Department of Justice and play at Sunset Bingo. You still need this. I've been involved since 1980. What you have here is pretty much, as explained by all parties, gambling in Oregon prohibited as by Constitution. But I will say that this is a road run twice before. It was run with grain machines, which were basically a form of a slot machine that you had to pass legislation to take care of. And then bingo also ran rampant. And I was familiar with it because we had to get licensed. And that time it was the Department of Commerce. They had about a three-quarter page rules and regulations. Everyone just ran around it and finally came before this body, not you specifically, in 87, that, you know, we're going to eliminate bingo or we're going to regulate bingo. And it was pretty wild times because most of bingo was controlled by out-of-state interests. And we went into business in 85, tried to abide by the laws, but it wasn't until a couple years later that we, in fact, had laws in place, and we are now regulated, controlled, audited, licensed, and taxed by the Oregon Department of Justice, and it was the only way that game could continue on, and it's the same thing here again. This is the third go-around, really, and the Department of Justice is certainly set up to handle this, and they can do it through rule development, and the games can propose certainly rules and concepts how they want to operate under the aegis of the Oregon Department of Justice. And so I would say that, you know, been here before a couple times, or at it again. It's uncontrolled and unregulated, and it will get bigger that way. So I'm in favor of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, all three of you. Final group, Joel Roth, Bill Dickus, and Josh Soldan.
Soldati.
Representatives of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I'm Joel Roth, manager, bingo manager at Sunset Bingo in Beaverton, Oregon. I've been there for 20 years. Bingo is a great outlet. Just like all these poker players, we have bingo players, and they are very fierce and loyal about their game, just as the poker players are. And I don't think anybody wants to take away poker from anybody. They just want to see it fairly handled through documentation, through reporting, dot all the I's, cross all the T's like we have to do in the bingo world. And when there's a problem, we have somebody to go to. If our players think there's a problem, we can direct them to the Department of Justice and they look into all problems. In fact, there have been a lot of problems over the years where there have been crooked bingo managers who've siphoned off money and they have been held accountable for. And that doesn't really happen very much anymore, because if you have regulation, you also have a deterrent. Nobody wants to get caught with their hand in the cookie jar. And there was a real important point made, that where are the owners of these poker clubs? Why are they not speaking out? All the poker players are speaking out. They don't want to lose their game. I don't want them to lose their game either. I just want the game to be run properly like it is in the big-time casinos in Vegas. And that's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir.
Thank you for staying. My name is Bill Dickus. I'm a lawyer. I'm a partner in the firm that represents the Washington Company. I'm just a contingent speaker. They've all said why we're for the bill.
Okay.
I do have just one point. The argument that poker isn't gambling, as my beloved deceased once senior partner used to say, is an argument that would fool only a lawyer. Nobody knows what card's coming next. Nobody. So we're for it. I'm for it, personally. I'm a recreational poker player. That's why I'm here. If it's going to happen, we want it to happen at a level where anybody could participate and operate, not just those who are willing to take the chance that they won't be prosecuted. That's why we're for the bill.
Thank you.
Chairman Garrett, members of the House Rules Committee, my name is Josh Soldati. I'm a vice president of marketing for a Fortune 500 company. I moved to Oregon in 2008 to live here. So I think it's a great state, and I've adopted it with enthusiasm. I'm here as a player and enthusiast, and I'm really here also with my friends. I met Roey Thorpe, who's become a good friend through poker. Another great friend I've met, Jen Bernard, who's the lead singer for a popular local band called Stolen Sweets, I met playing poker. So for me, it's been a really important social outlet, and I think that really gets to one of the key needs that social gaming is serving in Oregon. It's social gaming. It's a social enterprise. It's where you meet people. It's where you talk about the game. You talk about your kids. I've met dentists, lawyers, activists, police officers, everyone playing poker. As for whether poker is gambling or not, I like to describe poker as a mix of skill, courage, and luck, and with an emphasis on the skill. And I'm not the only one that thinks this way. A judge in New York City ruled that poker was a game of skill. You give two players, put them in a room, a professional and an amateur, and let them play for 3 hours, and I'll tell you who will win 70% of the time. So I think to characterize it as gambling is, as opposed to a game of skill, is a specious argument. I don't gamble. I don't play blackjack. I never put a dollar in a slot machine. I would never buy a scratch ticket or a lottery ticket or anything where I don't control the outcome or have an influence on the outcome. You don't know what cards are coming next, but you sure do control what you bet, how much you bet, when you bet it, when you check it. Another point I'd like to get to is these poker rooms are not casinos, and I know I'm repeating a lot of testimony. I played in a lot of casinos. Every casino I play in has a rake. They make money off of either every pot or off of every tournament. As has been stated before, and I'll just repeat it, none of the clubs I've played in Portland, and I've played in about four or five of them, make anything other than their cover fee and what they sell in food and drink. So whether I pay and play in four tournaments that day or one tournament, they don't make a dollar more. Whether they get 100 players or 1,000 players, the only dollars they're making are the entry fees for that day. They don't get any money from the pots that are played for. And they don't feel like casinos. They don't feel like casinos. They're not there to ensure that I drop as much money as possible into these games. Once I've walked through that door and paid that entry fee, they just hope I have a good time. That's all they're getting out of me, whatever beer and food I might buy. I think this is a bad bill, and I think I've heard a number of people testify for the bill, and I was keeping track, and I think everyone who testified for the bill was either a representative of a casino or a gaming association in Oregon, which clearly feels threatened by Oregon's current social gaming situation. I think that speaks volumes. I think it's a bad bill, but I also think the current situation is probably untenable. So I would suggest that we fix the current situation. But this current bill is like a nuclear bomb. It would shut down all the social gaming clubs in Oregon. And I don't think that's what, I've already heard, that's not what you want. That's not what some members want. So I would encourage the committee to find another path to resolve what's clearly an untenable situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that's a good note to end on. I think that summarizes it pretty well. We have a regulatory void here that needs to be addressed, although I don't think shutting down the clubs is anybody's wish. So thank you, everybody. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3518, and the committee's adjourned.